Hello, I'm Sheila Dillon, and welcome to this BBC download of the Food Programme. For information on the BBC's terms and conditions of use, visit www.bbc.co.uk/radio4. And now, enjoy the podcast.
Kentucky. Land outside of heaven to me.
It was only about 6 years ago that I first heard the name of Wendell Berry. It's a name that may not necessarily ring a bell this side of the Atlantic, but he's someone who's deeply influenced the thinking of how food should be produced. For decades, he's grappled with a question that vexed me. That when it comes to people and the ecological health of our land, what is the acceptable price to pay for producing food? Wendell farms where five generations of his family did, in Henry County, near the lower end of the Kentucky River Valley. This is deep farming country. I see fields of corn and black and brown cattle grazing in the tall grasses. Men lounge on verandas in the sun. The undulating road winds down to the valley floor towards the slow-moving Kentucky River. This is the landscape that is central to nearly all of Berry's writings. His body of work, over half a century in the making, includes 50 books of poetry, fiction and essays. It's extensive, but with one deeply felt message, that agriculture must be productive, but it also must preserve the land's ecological health and be to the benefit of the people who work on it. We should, he writes, eat with understanding and with gratitude. The first book I read by Berry was his classic The Unsettling of America. It's a fierce critique of the impact industrial agriculture had on small family farmers, communities and the land. And when it was published in 1977, US agribusiness was booming and farmers were told to get big or get out. Farmers are losing their farms, Berry wrote. Some are killing themselves, and rural economy and rural life are gravely stricken. Berry quickly emerged as a prophetic figure. He began the thinking that food campaigners and writers now continue. Here's acclaimed author Michael Pollan.
Wendell Berry is a hero of the modern food movement. He has a way of looking at things that will help you connect the dots between what's happening on your plate and what's happening on the farm, and also to make you realize how much is at stake ethically and morally in the way we handle the soil and the way we handle our meals.
Pulitzer Prize winner Michael Moss, author of Salt, Sugar, Fat.
Increasingly, people here are talking about the food chain and wanting to know, where does their meat come from? How were those animals treated? How were the people who raised those animals treated? And I think we're now starting to work backwards to something that Wendell Berry was teaching us about way back when.
And here's restaurateur and activist Alice Waters.
I saw how his farming, as much as his writing, expresses what he values: a reverence for nature and human community, a commitment to sustainability and frugality, a love of the miracle of life, its interconnectedness, and its beauty.
But his work resonates far beyond the US to influence the likes of me and many others. In Britain, with the hemorrhaging of farmers from dairying, it's hard not to reflect on Berry's writings. In my home country of Ireland, the number of farmers is drastically decreasing, and the rapid intensification of food production is putting biodiversity under persistent pressure. In the early 1960s, as an academic, Wendell taught English in New York University and Kentucky University. He's been involved in activism and campaigning, most recently for a 50-year farm bill that promotes the long-term interests of farmers and the environment. But his world is an intimate one. It's at home, on a small farm called Lane's Landing, which he bought in 1964 with his wife Tanya, where he lives and works today.
Hello. I got the right house. It's lovely to meet you.
Thank you.
I'm Ella.
When I arrive, Wendell is sitting in the wooden porch of his long-legged white house, his sheepdogs Maggie and Liz at his side. He's a tall, strong man of 81 years, and he wears a blue shirt with a notebook and pencil in the top pocket, which is neatly finished off with a thick pair of Made in America braces.
Won't you come in? Come in and I need to show you around a little bit.
Although he always kept a range of farm animals when his family was young, today he has his two workhorses and a flock of sheep. The rest of his farm is woodland and grassland. He speaks thoughtfully, and you can hear generations of Kentuckians in his deep voice. We went outside into the August heat and we walked down the steep steps to the road. Liz, his sheepdog, followed us and bounced into the back of his old white pickup truck, panting with excitement. Maggie, the less energetic of the two, decided to stay behind in the porch. Wendell drove about 200 metres along the road. He turned right and we entered his woodland.
We have several varieties of oak, several hickories.
Is a heron?
Yes, yeah. A great blue heron. I don't know whether we'll see deer on this trip or not, but early and late we'd be likely to see deer.
With so many books to his name, his message, asking us to think ecologically about food, is clear. We pull up and step out of his old white truck, and he explains more about the basis of his writings.
The overarching theme of my writing about agriculture is that there is a fundamental, incorrigible misfit between industrial values, procedures, and natures. And to farm properly, you have to begin with the nature of the place. Industrial agriculture doesn't begin with the nature of the place. It begins with the capacities and powers of the technology.
I came to your work via a book about soil and health by Sir Albert Howard, the British botanist, and, you know, what some say he's a pioneer of the organic movement.
Yeah.
He was someone that joined these realms of food and farming and land and environment.
He's been a major influence on all my writing. His question about how nature farms, how she would have used this land before we used it, is an absolutely indispensable question. He had that farmer's perspective, I think. So he was oriented not just to the practice of agriculture, but to the longevity. At some point, he had the wisdom, the inspiration to understand that he had to turn to nature.
You've been described as being the soul of the food movement here in America. And
oh,
I wanted
that's bullshit.
I wanted to ask your thoughts on that.
Well, there you are. I'm not the soul of any food movement, for God's sake. People are wrong. I mean, they're very generous, I think, to pin that kind of language on me. But in fact, no one person is going to be most important in any of these things that have happened. They can only happen because a lot of people want them to happen. That we have a movement for local food or organic food or whatever that may be comes about because a lot of people are willing to do a lot of work. Now, there is a conversation that's a public conversation, and I've taken part in that, there's no doubt about it. I would emphasize the part, and it's a relatively small part. Even if I say something that's true and useful, it doesn't do any good unless somebody else recognizes it, so it becomes, again, a matter of parts, a partnership.
One of your most quoted lines is, eating is an agricultural act, this idea that we must join and connect the realms of food with farming.
I wouldn't put it that way now. To say that eating is an agricultural act is approximately accurate, maybe. Allies, people whose side I'm on, seem to have liked that and they latched onto it. But I would try to be a little more exact now and say eating exercises an inescapable agricultural influence, or it inescapably influences agriculture. How you do it, what kind of food you require, demand of your suppliers, if you're a totally urban person.
When I started to read Berry's essays, I was like a hungry mosquito who'd found a juicy blood vessel, but his poetry can satiate in the same way. I asked him to read what is perhaps his most famous poem, The Peace of Wild Things.
When despair for the world grows in me, and I wake in the night at the least sound, in fear of what my life and my children's lives may be, I go and lie down where the wood drake rests in his beauty on the water and the great heron feeds. I come into the peace of wild things who do not tax their lives with forethought of grief. I come into the presence of still water, and I feel above me the day-blind stars waiting with their light. For a time, I rest in the grace of the world and am free.
I thought I might see my lambs, but they're not in there. We could send the dog.
He takes me to the field opposite his house where his lambs are grazing, but they're hiding in the long grass. Bit of a relief from the heat, I imagine. So he sends Maggie and Liz down towards the river's edge to find them.
Wait a me, Liz. Here. Here. Wait a me.
We're looking down on the Kentucky River
from
your land.
Yes.
It's very slow and lovely. I imagine if I put a microphone to it, it wouldn't make much noise.
Well, now, if it raised, it would be swift.
Did you play in it much when you were a young boy?
We swam in it a lot. Even after we moved here, we didn't have a very dependable summer water supply, so the kids and I bathed in the river quite often in those days.
Would you swim in it now?
Well, I know that it's got pollutants in it, and no, not very willingly.
When I read Berry's work and his insistence that before we think of food, we must first talk about the health of farmers, the land and rural communities, there's one story that sticks out. It's the winter of 1907, and Wendell's father, then just 6 years old, overhears his parents as they discuss money.
The cash crop of this country then, as until recently, was tobacco. My grandfather's crop was ready for the market, and it had been shipped to Louisville. My father remembered his parents talking the night before it was to be sold about what they would do with the money, which they badly needed. He came back that night, as my father put it, without a dime, because the crop had just paid its own transportation to market and the commission on its own sale. And of course, this made a deep impression on my father, and he saw in his childhood grown men leaving the tobacco markets crying. The situation was an arrangement pretty much made by James B. Duke, the head of the American Tobacco Company. Its power as a monopoly made them able, in effect, to steal the crop from the people who'd taken the risk and invested the labor. So I was down at Duke as a visiting writer or something, and I went out into the piazza in front of the chapel on the campus, and there was a statue of James B. Duke standing on the saint's pedestal in front of the church with a cigar between his fingers. It was a confrontation. All that history welled up in my mind, and I felt it very sharply.
You felt angry?
I felt angry, yeah. If you live with the memory of your own people suffering long enough, you imagine it, and it lives in you in a very real and poignant way. And of course, I felt some anger about it. So I grew up with a very strong anti-corporate bias and suspicion, and I think a very well-founded doubt that they will ever, on their own initiative, do anything very good or very generous.
Modern agriculture is based on consolidation and also inescapably the flight from land. I mean, the number of farmers is reducing and reducing. For example, in the UK, the number of dairy farmers is going down.
That's right. But the consolidation is not taking place on the farmer's side. The consolidation is all on the side of the agribusiness corporations. So they gather the power and they benefit from something that naturally happens, and that is overproduction. And if there are government subsidies of various kinds, that encourages overproduction. But you don't have to do anything to cause overproduction. The farmers themselves do it in order to make up for low prices. To remedy this, you've got to have production controls in the interest of the farmer.
You said that industrial agriculture looks at farmers as a worker acting on behalf of advice from scientists and economists, not as craftsmen of the highest order, a kind of artist. Can you expand on that, the notion of a farmer as a kind of artist?
Well, I like to regret the exclusive application of the term art to the so-called fine arts. Art is simply the name we give to the ways of making things. So that if I build a house, I do it by the art of carpentry or the art of stonemasonry. A highly diversified small farm that conserves the land and maintains its family is as productive as such a farm can be, involves solving structural problems that are in some ways even more difficult than the structural problems that are solved by novelists, for instance. There's no rest from that kind of thought, which and it's thought of a very high order, to depreciate the farmer socially and culturally to a figure who supposedly does mind-numbing work in terms of physical labor, of manual labor, is just a great tragic mistake. The people who talk this way are urban and academic in their outlook. They can't imagine anybody who actually worked with his or her body as having a mental life. It's ignorance. And it's a terrible, costly, tragic prejudice.
For people who want to, shall we say, verify their life, you know, they live in urban centres, they try to make good choices with their foods, they want to live a bit of your philosophy. What should we do?
First of all, we've got to change the standards. You can't use the industrial standards and ever cure the industrial wrongs. The standards are the greatest speed possible, the greatest power possible, efficiency according to a mechanical standard, productivity as opposed to fertility, and profit. Those standards won't work for agriculture. For the good of agriculture, or they won't work for the good of the land being used by agriculture. So you need to change the standard. You need to do what Albert Howard did. You need to be asking, well, if we weren't here, what would nature be doing here? And an education starts there.
Can I ask you what you think your work says to communities, people who live in low-income neighborhoods in urban spaces? And I'm thinking of young, for example, African Americans in Baltimore, in Louisville.
I never ceased to think of them. There used to be a lot of black people here in this county and nearly all of them were working in farm work. Some of them were my teachers, and some I loved very much. They're gone. It was a rather gentle migration here. They went mostly because they wanted to, when they wanted to. Dayton, Ohio was a kind of a mecca here, and a lot of our people went there. But they did move from a situation that they knew how to live in, and away from neighbors, even white neighbors who knew them well, into a situation that they didn't really know how to live in. And it was worse for the African Americans or the black people of the South, of the sugar cane and cotton fields, who just were suddenly obsolete when the big machines came in. And they had to go somewhere. And so they went to the cities. And you notice that the black people who ought to have been given, after segregation, a place here as landowners, as people integrated into the local economy. But it's too late for that. They're now disconnected, white and black, from their history.
But for people who don't live an agrarian life or who can't afford to buy land, especially those in low-income urban areas, just how and where they can access fresh local food and support good farming practices is a complex question. Wendell's philosophy is being put into practical action, though. Just 40 miles south of Lane's Landing is the home of Kentucky Fried Chicken and Muhammad Ali, the city of Louisville. It's here that the problems of urbanization and the modern food system are laid bare.
I don't think that people make the connection to eating with farming. I think most people associate food with supermarkets.
Amber Burns lives in West Louisville. It's an area of six neighborhoods with about 80,000 primarily African-American residents. There's a large road called Ninth Street, which divides this lower income area from the more affluent and mainly white East Louisville. West Louisville has been classified as a food desert for many years. The disconnection from farmers and the land is something Amber recognizes.
Whenever I thought of farming, I thought of slavery. I thought of my people being tied to the land against their will. I thought of my grandmother being a sharecropper in South Carolina, picking 300 pounds of cotton a day as a child. And so my connection to the land is a very conflicted one. But had I had the opportunity to see a farmer that looked like me and be given a positive image of black people being in the land and growing willingly and it making them happy, I think that would have made me view agriculture in an entirely different way and look at it the way it should be looked at, as a profession that should be praised and honored and really treasured.
Of the 75,000 farmers in Kentucky, I'm told only 300 or so are African American. Ashley Clark Thompson is in her late 20s. I meet her in Franco's, a soul food diner on the Dixie Highway in West Louisville, where she grew up.
Wendell Berry has a huge impact on the people of my generation. My parents' generation, specifically thinking about my mother, she grew up in the feminist wave where she didn't have to cook. It was optional. And it's interesting with my generation, I find that me and my friends are getting back to wanting to cook and wanting to can and grow our own things. But also just in terms of taking care of ourselves and of our environment, cooking locally, you know, shopping locally is all made a really, really big impact, I think, on my generation. I definitely think it is a challenge to be political with our forks. Unfortunately, you know, I know in Louisville that there are places where there are food deserts, where there isn't available fresh produce. Basically, there are parts of town where it's hard to get fresh food, where packaged food is the norm. It's cheap, it's readily available, and it will give you those calories that you need. It shouldn't be a luxury to be able to go to a farmer's market.
Asked to start a farmer's market in an urban food desert, and I couldn't convince one farmer to set up and sell. Whereas on the other side of town, across 9th Street, there are 27 farmer's markets. There are none on the west side of town.
A few years ago, Karen Moskowitz set up a non-profit organization called New Roots. It works with farmers to create a local food supply chain. Karen believes that Louisville is afflicted by food apartheid, a lack of fresh and affordable food that disproportionately affects the health of low-income residents. In response, West Louisville residents are now rejecting the standards set by the modern food industrial system.
I would say that African American youth in West Louisville are very disconnected from the land and from Wendell Berry and his teachings. I think that their main concern is basically getting through the day on very limited resource, some of them, you know, and making something of themselves. And sometimes that means just grabbing fast food meals and really simply not worrying about it.
But crediting Wendell's influence, Karen has changed that. Out of new roots, she began the Fresh Stop Project.
Maybe one family alone won't be able to afford to pay retail prices at a farmer's market or even a grocery store. But by pooling cash and food stamps or government food subsidies, we are able to amass a large amount of funds and then be able to go to the farmers and promise them a market. It's a certain amount of money, a certain amount of families, and then each family can pay in on a sliding scale, and then we're able to have a share of the bounty that's in season that day for each family. But what people are really coming for is the community. There may be people who have never, if they've lived in the East End of Louisville, crossed over to the West End to meet people and make friends. So there's people in the community who are discussing these vegetables, so everybody's sharing information and knowledge and gaining a lot of confidence in cooking from scratch.
While Wendell Berry plays down his significance, it's obvious that people who've read his work have moved on it. Back in Henry County, Wendell sits on his rocking chair in a living room adorned from floor to ceiling with books, and I ask him to reflect on his 8 decades.
I know that you once described your father sitting on the porch at the age of 81, and you asked him what kind of life he had had, and he said to you, "I have had a wonderful life and I haven't had much to do with it."
"Had nothing to do with it," he said.
And I know that you turned 81 a few days ago, and yeah, I wanted to ask you the same question, what kind of life you've had.
Well, it's not as if that I've had a master plan that I've followed. It's that pretty much I've done what my heart has prompted me to do again and again and again.